Good afternoon, everyone. This is Chair Ruth Richardson, and pursuant to House Rule 10.1, I call this remote hearing of the Education Policy Committee to order. And let's get started with Ellen. Would you be able to please take the roll for us?
Chair Richardson?
Present.
Vice Chair Hassan? Representative Erickson?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski?
Present.
Representative Bennett? Representative Berg?
Present.
Representative Bowe? Representative Christensen?
Present.
Representative Edelson?
Present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Frazier?
Present.
Representative Jordan?
Present.
Representative Keeler?
Present.
Representative Moeller?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Poston? Representative Scott? Representative Erdahl? Representative Wasliwick?
Present.
Vice Chair Hassan? Representative Bennett?
Laura, I think Representative Bennett will be late.
All right. Representative Poston?
Representative Poston should have announced that he is ill.
All right. And Representative Erdahl? Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
Thank you. Thank you, Ellen. Representative Erickson, have you had an opportunity to review the January 11th minutes? And are you willing to make a motion to adopt the minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, our very brief minutes. I move approval of those.
Thank you. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, thank you. So today we're going to be continuing to hear from the Minnesota Department of Education, and we also have the Minnesota Department of Health joining today to talk about Minnesota's safe learning plans. I'd like to welcome both Deputy Commissioner Mueller and Assistant Commissioner Huff to today's presentation, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. We really appreciate having the opportunity to be here today. I am Heather Mueller, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Education.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. I am Dan Huff. I am an Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health.
And we're going to walk through with you just some pieces around the safe learning plan and also some of the health components that fall within the safe learning plan. And so I believe Megan is going to be projecting the presentation this afternoon. Thank you very much, Megan. Dan, would you like to begin?
Pardon me. Thank you, Heather. So, Madam Chair, members, education and children being in schools is directly tied to public health. Education is a key social determinant of health. We know that educational attainment and individual health status are closely correlated. Schools are an important part of our public health system. That's where our children really receive many children receive their nutrition there. That's where we do health interventions. It's where we do early childhood screening. A number of health care and public health interventions occur in our schools. And during this pandemic, some of our students have done quite well, but unfortunately, many others are being left behind. We know that children spending less time with their contact teacher means that they are more likely to do poorly academically. Unfortunately, this often goes along racial lines, which increases disparities that we already see in education and in public health. And we know that chronic absenteeism, that is missing more than 10 school days, does affect one's ability to achieve in education, especially around reading, grade retention, graduation, and dropout rates. Next slide, please. The CDC, understanding the need to prioritize education, has put together this chart for us that I think is helpful. Whenever we look at any setting in public health, we look at disease risk and how do we mitigate or lower that risk. Any time that we are socializing, interacting with people outside of our household pod during a global pandemic, there is risk of disease spread. So in looking at this chart here, the CDC talked about, well, what are things that we can do to mitigate this risk? And number one is masking. Two is social distancing as much as possible, hand hygiene, covering your cough, respiratory etiquette, cleaning, disinfection, and then contact tracing. These are all parts of the safe learning plan. One thing that's also important is the CDC comments that the lower your amount of community spread, the lower the risk of being in school. That's why the governor's dial back over December was so important to reduce our level of community spread to make it safer for schools to go back into session. Next slide, please. Next slide. So just some highlights. We know that this pandemic is impacting families. I think all of us know it's impacting our mental health. It's impacting our abilities for families just to avoid conflict with each other. But it also is impacting early childhood screening, food security, healthcare access for our young people. There are specific challenges for those who are already having difficulty navigating the systems. So single parents, special education families, low-income families, our BIPOC communities. Now, our data for 2020 is limited, but we do know that there are definite impacts for being out of school and just for the pandemic in general on our children. Next slide, please. Healthcare access continues to be a concern. Now, we in Minnesota pride ourselves on healthcare access, but we do know that during the pandemic, childhood vaccination rates has declined. Next slide, please. Early childhood screening, once again, we have we're seeing a decrease in the number of children screened this year, or this rather the 2019-2020 over the 2018 year, due, we believe, in a large part because of the pandemic and children just not having access to school. Next slide, please. I think this is probably fairly intuitive, but mental health for all of us is suffering. The pandemic is, we have very difficult times in this country, and pandemic is one of those major stressors. Depression is itself a public health issue, but also our immune systems function less well when we're facing these emotional and mental health issues. Next slide. Food security. Many of our children rely upon school lunch and school breakfast. They rely upon our schools to provide the bulk of their basic nutrition. Now, we have done, and under Governor Walz's leadership, there has been tremendous effort working with school districts throughout the state, working with community-based organizations, local public health, to do everything we can to make sure that children are fed and that their nutritional needs are met. But it has been difficult, and we are concerned about children still falling through the cracks that normally would have been, those cracks would not have been there for in-person learning. Next slide, please. Families are stressed. People are stressed. And as a result, we're seeing an increase in maltreatment reports, an increase in family violence and family abuse. At the same time, those social interventions, those social service interventions that we have in place have suffered due to the pandemic. So a 5% drop in case management for in-home face-to-face contact. And we see this very disparately managed across the state just because of the different levels of capacity and resources that go from county to county. Next slide, please. So if we look at one of the big risks that we are concerned about with children and staff going back to school is obviously transmission occurring in the school. As I said, any time that we are interacting with other people, that we are swapping air, as Dr. Mike Osterholm likes to say, swapping air with another person, we are at risk of either transmitting or receiving a virus, a respiratory virus like COVID. The higher the level of transmission in the community, that higher the risk when we interact with people outside of our household. Schools are definitely an area where that risk exists. And if we look at, now we cannot say for certainty where someone caught the disease unless they're in a defined setting and we know exactly who they got it from when we have a clear case contact. But in community cases, such as in schools, it's often difficult for us to say, did that person actually contract the virus in a school, or did they pass it on to someone else in the school? What we do know is we have records of when people attended school during the period in which they would have been infectious. And so you can see, looking at both staff and students, yes, we have had students and staff that have been infected. We have had some that attended school while infectious and some that were not attending school while infectious. What I think this slide shows, though, is there is not a clear difference between elementary and secondary. And that may indicate be based more on community spread. It may be based more on in the school setting. As I said, the risk exists, but we can't pinpoint exactly where that spread occurred. Next slide, please. One of the things that we did is we wanted to see, okay, what's the driver? Are schools driving infections, or is the community spread driving the infections? And now this rather confusing scatter plot here has a barn full of caveats to these data. What this shows, though, what we did, let me just explain this chart. We looked at the incidence of the disease for kids 5 to 19 age range, and how did it compare to the percent of student days for in-person learning. Now, in-person learning itself is tied to community spread. We would anticipate that as community spread goes up, more kids are going to be infected. What we want, why we looked at this is to see, is there a strong correlation between student infection and being in school versus not being in school. And what we found is there's no red flags. There's no blazing alarm in here. We can't say for certain one way or the other, but there was nothing that really alarmed us to say, wow, there is such a strong correlation between in-person and higher rates. It really seemed to be governed much more by the broader tide of community spread and community rates. That is, when we had a really big peak in November, we had that peak not only in the majority of the population, but also in 5 to 19-year-olds. And as that peak went down with the pause, then the rates in 5 to 19-year-olds also went down with the pause. Next slide. Okay, I'm going to turn this back over now to Deputy Commissioner Dr. Mueller.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So in really looking at the data that we have around where we are with students and in-person learning and in hybrid learning, as well as distance learning now, as of Friday, January 8th, you'll see that on the left-hand map, that's what we have identified for our students currently for our in-person. We have roughly 31% of our districts who are moving to an in-person, which is way up from where it was in January at about 13%. And then we have a combination of a model as well as the hybrid model, and then finally the distance learning model. On the right-hand side, you'll see that for our students, our secondary students in grades 6 through 12, they are still primarily in a distance learning model. We do know that beginning on January 18th, which is on Monday, districts will be able to start their rolling start and begin, and that's part of the safe learning plan, which we're going to talk about here in just a second, but they will have the opportunity to start to come back very slowly. They're working with their regional support teams, and so that has that information. We'll be talking through some of that information as well. Next slide, please. Thank you. So when the Safe Learning Plan was announced at the end of July, we really identified that there were five primary goals that we wanted to consistently have at the forefront. First and foremost, we wanted to prioritize the safety, health, and wellness of our students, staff, and families. And then once we could ensure or attain that, we wanted to prioritize in-person learning. And like the hope would be for all. But if we had to differentiate, then we would start with our youngest learners and those who needed in-person instruction most. We also needed to recognize the differences in the potential spread among our different age groups, cognizant not only of that for our elementary students, our middle school students, and our high school students, but also for our staff. And then also thinking about how it is that we can support our planning while we're also making sure that we have flexibility with our local education agencies to ensure that we have that symbiotic relationship of providing support and guidance and providing the flexibility that comes with being a school, a public school district. And then also taking into account the disease prevalence at the local level. Like, how can we use the data that was available to us to be able to help to determine where we should start and the information that we need in order to continue? Next slide, please. So given that, in our partnership with the Department of Health, we developed the Safe Learning Plan, which really was a five-step process. The first was to really think through the data that we utilized at the county level. It's then working with our developing a consultative process with our regional support teams, and we'll talk about it in a minute. Also then working with our public schools and their incident command teams in that process, in that consultative process with the regional support teams, local public health, Department of Health, to really look at not only their data at the county level, but also look at their school level data and their community data. And then just take into consideration what that model is going to look like. How are you going to be communicating that within your school communities? And then how are we going to continue to monitor that information so that as you see spikes or as you see declines in your school and in your community, you can make adjustments based off of that. Next slide, please. Thank you. So those regional support teams were really created in partnership with MDE, our Department of Health, our Minnesota Regional Service Cooperatives, and our local public health officials. And those are the members who sit on those teams. They have been able to provide essentially a hub for all of the school districts and charter schools that are in their areas to help to provide not only information in the consultative process, but professional development, information on data, and a basic connection point and service liaison roles between the State Department of Health, the Department of Education, and our regional support teams. And really, they're able to help support things like our learning models, health best practices and requirements, reviewing of plans to give any types of feedback, action steps for when there are COVID cases. We needed to make sure that our school leaders had the opportunity to have an immediate response and immediate support, and then COVID testing for our school communities. Thank you. And so really looking at assessing the cases for school after opening is we really had to start thinking about, and this was the questions we asked ourselves from the very beginning, like how many cases are there? Are they close together? And the time are they spread out over several weeks? And how is that not only impacting at the county level, but really looking at our communities and then what's happening in our schools? What are there any common themes? Are the close contacts happening as a result of something that's happening in the school, near the school, or behaviors around the schools and in the community? And how are our students and staff and families coming into contact with COVID positive cases? And then just thinking about any other significant transmission that's happening in the community, and then are we able to maintain that current model? We did see that as we moved into November and December, a number of our schools, both at the elementary, middle, and high school level, needed to move to a distance learning model, not because our students necessarily were testing positive, but because we had a number of staff who were either testing positive or who were quarantined. And so because of that, the staffing became an issue for a number of our school districts. And so we wanted to make sure that we were continuing to think about how is it that we can continue to prioritize in-person learning with looking at additional mitigation strategies, thinking about where we are at the very beginning, the very first thing that we used, and we appreciate the Department of Health really setting up that model to be able to utilize county-level data, because beginning on March 18th, we had no information about what was happening in schools. And so when this plan was initially released in July, the only point of context that we had was the county-level data as a place to start. And then as schools were moving in and doing some of that work, they used some of the components of then their community data as well as their school-level data. We also know that as we were looking at students who are more and more moving into a distance learning model because of issues that were happening exposures and quarantine, we also were really thoughtful and considerate about the fact that our students were at almost a full year of disrupted education since March 18th of last year. We understand and know the long-term and the short-term implications of not having our students in person, that the distance that is going to be changing the trajectory. When we know that the role that in-person learning plays for our students, and based on the evolving knowledge and our understanding of the virus, to modify to modify the safe learning plan and rely less on the county level data, specifically at the early learning and K-5 level, and increasing those mitigation strategies was something that we thought was an important component to be able to add in our partnership. And it really was a reminder that we're not really reopening schools. We had a number of our schools throughout greater Minnesota that had been full in-person learning since the beginning of fall and had implemented a number of mitigation strategies to be able to continue to have students in person. Again, even those districts in greater Minnesota that had been in person in the fall did find that they needed to step back a little bit and move either to a hybrid or a distance learning model simply because of staff exposures and quarantines. Move forward, please. Thank you. And really thinking, I know that Dan was able to outline a number of the social emotional components and the mental health components, and we understand the roles that schools play in the lives of our students and families. There are also the academic components that we think are incredibly important to be able to think through and talk about. We know that our young children in particular will be impacted by not having in-person learning, and we need to be thoughtful about those in those long-term academic consequences, and how is it that we are not going to exacerbate those inequities if they fall behind? We know that in our grades K through 3, children are still developing their skills to be able to regulate their behavior, their emotions, their attention, and then the increase in the use of distance learning at those age ranges means that those are other pieces that they are not having the opportunity to learn, not only from their teachers and but also from their peers. And we also know the benefits of opening us, having school buildings open, and that they provide not only academic learning and support, but childcare settings, school services and meals, and other family supports. In addition, I know that most of you would know that the additional research around K-3 education and the important role of reading and English language arts. We know that those students who are not reading on grade level by third grade tend to be the most vulnerable to drop out later in life. We know that the dropout rates can be tracked essentially straight back to, in a number of instances, our third grade reading rates, and that approximately in some research, you'll see that 88% of the students who did not earn a high school diploma also were struggling readers in third grade. We can move forward, please. And so based on that understanding of the virus, like we said, and really thinking through the schools that were not in person and wanting to have our students move back to an in-person model, we really wanted to put forward a strategy that and multiple strategies that we're going to be able to help them move back into the buildings. And so move forward, please. So some of those mitigation strategies were that we were first and foremost going to be implementing a rolling start for students to be brought back into the building. In our collaboration with our health colleagues, we really wanted to make sure that we were doing this in a very methodical approach, giving the opportunity for students to come into a building be in that building for a set amount of time for 2 weeks. And give them the chance to set up their routines, their systems, and structures, making sure that we are maintaining all of the safety and mitigation strategies. And then we would have the opportunity then to roll in some additional grade levels. And those grade bands were looking at 3 grade levels per aspect of that rolling start. We also were executing the COVID-19 testing program. And so making sure that we were standing up testing for every single staff member who wanted to be tested. We're not compelling people to test. They don't have to if they don't want to. But to ensure that we have tests available to all staff on a biweekly basis. So that way we have worked with our critical care work group to ensure that we have not only those critical supplies, but we also have the testing components available to build in those tests every other week on a rotating basis. Also face masks and face shields. We did move forward with getting additional face masks for every single staff member who interacts in the school, as well as face shields. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. And then also, if we were not able to maintain that 6 feet of different distance between an adult and the students, then we did strongly recommend that they have some type of physical barrier or clear barrier between them and the students. Just because we know of that prolonged time period being together, we wanted to make sure that we had some additional components. Some additional mitigation strategies, specifically physical education classes who are operating indoors need to ensure that they have are wearing face coverings. Arts classes, and when we say arts, we don't mean just specifically the art class, but arts in general, art, music, media, STEM classes, that they can continue to be held indoors. They can be held in individual classrooms if that seems the most appropriate to be able to maintain a cohort for your students, or following the guidance that was laid out by the Department of Health, they can follow the guidance to allow students to be moving throughout the building and move into their each of their special area spaces. And then one of the pieces we've talked a lot about is that there are also those components around not only thinking about the cohorting of students and really trying to create pods of students and staff so that way that contact tracing is a very wide, easy process and maintains a kind of sets up an ecosystem within that classroom. We also know that we have students who need special education services, EL services, gifted and talented services, as well as counseling services. And that doesn't always come solely from one classroom or one grade level. There are times when students do mix from multiple grade levels, and for the academic purposes, for the compelling purposes, it would be appropriate to bring students from a variety of grade levels, but what we would need to do there is to allow them to come together from those grade levels. They would need to be masked. They would need to maintain, be able to have 6 feet of distance between them, because we want to try to maintain and follow the health guidance around that barrier. And we know that the physical distancing does for the mitigation strategy, but also give students the opportunity to have these services that are incredibly important for them. We also talked about the fact that students could either, they could choose to have meals in their classrooms, or they could be eating in a cafeteria. Again, try to cohort students, and so keep your, you know, your classroom together at all times during that particular time that you're eating your meal, breakfast or lunch, and then students can come back. Also, in an in-person model from the very beginning in July, if you were in an in-person model, you did not need to maintain 6 feet of physical distancing in the classroom setting. The recommendation is to try to have at least 3 feet, but between the adult and the student to maintain 6 feet, but for the students themselves, they could be less than 3 feet together. Some additional pieces around that rolling start that we talked a little bit about is we've talked about no more than 3 additional grade bands can be introduced per school building in a 2-week time period. So that includes, like, if you're transitioning from a hybrid model into an in-person learning model. Now, there are ways to be able to, ongoing conversations with our school leaders as well as with our Department of Health, really looking at ways that we would be able to expand that. So, for example, if your pre-kindergarten classrooms or your kindergarten classrooms can be self-contained, they are not interacting with other grade levels, they either come in a separate entrance or they're coming in at an entrance at a different time, they eat on their own, they have recess on their own, all of those different pieces. If they really are not interacting with the rest of the school community, then that self-contained classroom technically, or classrooms, do not fall into that rolling start. So it's possible that if you are self-contained in pre-K and you are self-contained in kindergarten, you could bring in pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and grades 1, 2, and 3. In that first 2-week period, because it really is looking at what that's looking at, looks like. And we've had a number of schools that, quite frankly, from the very beginning in fall, who have either been in person or in hybrid, have worked really hard to self-contain simply because they knew the importance of that cohorting model. And so we've had a number of schools that were able to do this rolling start process rather simply because of that, because of the work that they had already done. Thank you. Some examples of ways that schools could think about bringing students back in. So for example, again, they could look at having a K-2 in in-person learning and grades 3 through 5 in distance learning. Or you could also look at having a K-1 in grades 2 through 6 in a hybrid learning, right? Just thinking about it, additional ways that these are only examples. This is not what they were required to do. And a number of our school leaders have really worked with their incident command teams, worked with their school boards, worked with their families to really be thoughtful about what is the best way to bring students into the building if they had not been in the building, and how is it that we bring them back in coming out of winter break. The regular COVID testing we've talked a little bit about, it really is one of those pieces where we wanted to add that component in. We know that having that testing background ensures that staff know whether they're symptomatic or asymptomatic. If they do have COVID, it gives us the opportunity to remind them that they need to step away at least. And it continues to also give peace of mind to our staff. We understand that there are a number of staff who are concerned because of their families they either interact with, that the families that they have at home, or for they themselves, and they want to make sure that they are being as safe as possible. And we wanted to provide them with that peace of mind and with the information that they needed to continue to make some of those really important decisions. Thank you. We also know that it's for any staff, so our bus drivers, our people who work in food service, our paraprofessionals, our classroom teachers, anyone who is interacting with students, they have the option to participate in the testing program. And we can continue. And so those were some of the cruxes of the pieces that really changed. Most of there was a lot of continuity that maintained in the safe learning plan. A lot of the parameters still exist. Really looking at cohorting our students, making sure that you're having recess outdoors. We know that in our Minnesota winters, sometimes that's not possible. We also know that we are a hardy group of people who can do a whole lot of things. And so students love to be able to go outdoors as well and to have recess. And that gives them a break, not only the physical break that often our students need, but they do not need to necessarily wear a mask when they are outside doing some of those recess those recess activities, maintaining that safe distancing, making sure that we follow the health parameters, and then working with your regional support teams. We're not going to pretend like it is not possible that we will see that a school or a school community needs to move back into a hybrid model or a distance learning model because of something that's happening within that school or because there are a number of staff who are in quarantine. And so that regional support team is going to continue to be an integral component to working with our school leaders. And our secondary staff, our secondary schools and our school leaders have been working to talk about how is it that they are bringing back our middle school students and our high school students. Again, they are also in that rolling start, but in a number of our buildings, in a middle school building, grade levels can be self-contained. There is a seventh grade wing or an eighth grade wing, or the sixth grade never sees the eighth grade. And so in the ways that they can be maintained cohort and still be in a more of a self-contained opportunity than in that same rolling start is the very similar thing. Thank you. And then what really primarily has changed is that there's the reduction in the use of the county level data as a singular point or determining point of data, especially at the elementary level. We've added mitigation strategies as well as that rolling start. And then some of the pieces that we're continuing to think about, right, what additional pieces of data are continuing to look at, like hospital beds and the percentages that are available, any of that school level data so that they are working with their regional support teams and some of those pieces. And with that, the final thing is, you know, we are never working to make these decisions alone or in a vacuum. We recognize that across the nation and across the world, there are schools that are having to make decisions about what is happening with how they support their students, how they work with their local school officials to support students' education. And so we also are, you know, took the time and are consistently looking at models that are around us, models that are very far from us, and thinking about those implications and ways that we can continue to be able to support the safety of our students and staff and families, but also bringing our students back to in-person learning. And I think with that, we are done with our time.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Mueller, and also Assistant Commissioner Huff for the presentation. Before we jump into questions, I do just want to recognize that Vice Chair Hassan, Representatives Bennett, Scott, and Erdahl, and Bo have all arrived since the roll call. And with that, I see the first hand that I believe has been raised is Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Richards, and thank you for the department for your presentation today. I do have a couple of questions that I wrote down. And if you go back to slide 11, I'll give the department a minute to get back there. I noted that it says that that the data suggests transmission potential exists at nearly equal portions in both elementary and secondary for both staff and students, then why is this plan right now only to get elementary schools back going if the data says that there's no difference for staff or students for elementary or secondary?
Deputy Commissioner or Assistant Commissioner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to take that. Yes, Representative, we do not have very good data on the differences between, say, an 8-year-old and a 12-year-old, what the difference is in their ability to transmit the disease. We know that children and young people are infected. What we know also, though, is that they are differently affected. So young people, the younger the individual, the less likely they are to be impacted by severe disease. Now, it does not mean it does not happen. We do have young children that are impacted by severe disease. We have there's a rare inflammatory disorder associated with COVID. But on average, a young person, a young child, will have much less likelihood of severe disease, of being hospitalized, or of dying than an older adolescent or an adult. So it's less about the amount of spread and more about how does that impact the individual, so that the younger the individual, the less severe the impact of COVID.
Thank you, Representative Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So just a follow-up on the clarification. So do you have Minnesota specific data on what you just stated as far as the severity of the virus for older versus younger students? Or is that just, you know, anecdotal from the CDC or, you know, some other data that you're looking at? Do you have Minnesota specific data?
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Madam Chair, Representative, what's not anecdotal, it is based upon scientific research and scientific papers. I do not have at my fingertips the Minnesota data, but we do track per age people that are hospitalized, people that are infected, people that die. And so we do see that while we have had a few people, younger people who have been hospitalized, we've had no fatalities in very young people, and that we do definitely see an age range and age progression in our Minnesota data. If you're interested in that, I'm happy to provide that for you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I would really be interested in seeing that data, and I would like to see that data in light of how that would be any different than the seasonal flu or some sort of a flu as far as hospitalization or whatever. I know that in the state of Minnesota, the last time I checked, the Department of Health's website and the daily specifics that we get from them, that under the age of 19, only one death for anyone, and that was an infant and of just a few months old, I believe. I just want to make sure that we're following the data, and so that was one of my questions. And then the other question I had, Madam Chair, and then this that I'll be finished, is on slide 14, and point number four, and the support planning while permitting flexibility for districts. And, you know, there was a great level of frustration in my school district, which is in Okehennepin, of course, the largest in the state, over the, you know, initially this summer, it was going to be based on the number of cases per county, which I thought was, you know, not a good reflection or a good barometer to use in assessing whether kids should be in school or not, because you could have an outbreak at a nursing home that has absolutely zero to do with any of the kids, because the nursing home are pretty much shut down, and it could shut down schools. And so there was, you know, there's a lot of unrest and just displeasure in Okehennepin right now. And a lot of it has to deal with the criteria used. And then we found out that the department really hadn't communicated anything different than those starting criteria for school starting in the fall, and that they were providing more flexibility, but the school districts weren't made aware of that. And so the school districts were operating under one assumption, and the department failed to communicate effectively with the superintendents and with the schools as far as any other criteria that might be taken into consideration and which model that the schools are using. And I'm just wondering if somebody could address the breakdown of communication there and what you've done to repair that. Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Mueller or Assistant Commissioner Huff, which of you would like to take that?
I will do that. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. And thank you very much for the question. I think that there are a couple of pieces. The first is that this has always been the ability to use additional data has always been part of the Safe Learning Plan. It has been in step five from the very beginning. We had a number of districts from across the state that had been utilizing not only the county level data, but their community data and their school level data. for to be in person or to be moving to varying learning models. And that is how we were able to move from maybe a hybrid model to a distance learning model and then back into a hybrid model. We always utilized at the regional support team level, we utilized those regional support teams because in those conversations, in those consultative conversations, they not only talked about the county level data, but they also talked about the school level data as well as the community data. And we were able to take into account the fact that it is possible that in some of our counties, it was because of something that was happening in a long-term care facility. It was something that was happening in a prison setting. And so we understood that also a county is a very large county, and it could be something that's happening in one of the larger communities, but in some of our smaller surrounding communities, that was not what we were seeing. And so that had always been a part of the process from the very beginning. And we had worked with our school leaders in those conversations, as well as with our regional support team coordinators. And so I think that we are continuing to hone and continue to be more clear. I think the example that you gave, a representative specific to Anoka Hennepin and superintendent, we consistently are working with a superintendent Law on those pieces, simply because, you know, they are one of the largest school districts, and immediately are continuing to reach out and support that. But that it has been a part of the plan from the very beginning, and we are continuing to hold. We also have held since March. We had first for the first March until about July, we had daily school leader calls. So every single day we had our school leaders from across the state on calls to be able to give updates and to provide clarification and conversations. We also send out once a week, then actually we were sending out daily newsletters with all of the information that we had talked about in case a school leader wasn't able to make those calls, and we had all of the information in a document. We do now do those school leader calls on every single Thursday. We also are continuing to send out the newsletters and the feedback. We do have also a teams of people who are coming together from all of the education organizations. We visit through the regionals, each of the regional support or each of the regional superintendent gatherings that come from across the state. We are on those and are invited to those and asked to join those on a regular basis, as well as have transition group meeting where we have school leaders from across the state, as well as local public health, the Department of Health, school nurses, regional support team coordinators, our charter school leaders as well. We've also partnered with our private school leaders and made sure that they also have the regional support teams. And we've made a number of individual calls where both Commissioner Ricker and I have every single superintendent or school leader across the state has our cell phone numbers and have we've reached out and had those conversations pretty regularly. So there are a number of things that we have done and that we are continuing to do to ensure that our communication continues to not only be a really solid source of information, but we continue to get better at that.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. And I will just note that we've got a number of members with questions. Representative Scott, just want to make sure that you don't have any follow-up from that.
Oh, I probably do, but I'll let other people have the floor. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to both commissioners for being here to present this important material to us. In regard to the regional centers, would they be able to, Deputy Commissioner Mueller, provide us with a preliminary report that includes data from each of the regions that they were addressing as they helped the schools with their different learning models? Because I think it's important for us to get that data and that information, perhaps even a timeline, because you can imagine all of the consternation that has occurred among our parents, among our teachers, among our students during this period. So I think it's important for us to know how the regional centers have assisted in allaying the fear that certainly has dominated the learning place, even the home. So I request that, and then what your plans are for ensuring that when students are returning in person, what is being done through the regional centers of excellence to help in the literacy and math areas where we know our students have suffered great loss? So I look forward to that. I also have a question about the shields for the teachers is just recommended. Deputy Commissioner Mueller, I was told that that was a mandate. Would you respond to that, please?
Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Erickson. And so there's a couple of different pieces. One, face masks are continue to be required. Face shields are strongly recommended. They are not required to have during at any point in time. When we worked with our at the very beginning of the relaunch or essentially of the update of that safe learning plan, one of the things that we did have in there is that we from our partnerships is we needed to have both the face mask and the face shield. As we continue to work with our school leaders as well as with our Department of Health colleagues to talk about, right, some of the places where that would be a very difficult component to have, there was the opportunity to say that the recommendation then from the strong recommendation from our Department of Health is that they have both. And I think that that Assistant Commissioner Huff would continue to say that they do believe that having both a face mask and a face shield are a stronger mitigation strategy than just the face mask. However, we also understand that there were some of the academic components and that school leaders could make the decision to, and we were gonna give them to everyone. So if an individual staff member chooses to wear that, then they may do that. Also, a school leader could make the decision to work with their staff, and if that was something that they all wanted to do, then that was something that they could do.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Excuse me. Thank you for that answer. I think too many teachers thought it was mandatory, and so they were very frustrated, especially at the K-2 and 3 levels, where there needs to be, you know, really pure eye contact with our young ones, and that was very disturbing to them. Another question is, who at the department, or maybe at both departments, were in charge of the safe learning plan? You know, did we have a safe learning czar? And then another question is, who was overseeing the distance learning that was going on other than the regional centers that you noted?
Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Representative Erickson. I don't think that there is a safe learning plan czar. I think that we've had a partnership from the very beginning with our Department of Health to be able to, it's not a singular person who is running, I think, everything. I think what we do have is the opportunity to have points of lead. And so on different aspects of the, of the safe learning plan, different people led. And so there was a coordination efforts to be able to do this work. And then the second question around the distance learning models, we have a safe learning portal where schools are able to share with us first and foremost, not only what their learning models are, but they tell us essentially what those time bands and time frames are. They are going to be either in a hybrid model or a distance learning model, which is how we kind of have a sense of where they are in each of those pieces. And I don't know, Assistant Commissioner Huff, if you wanted to talk about anything from your perspective from the health team.
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we don't have a, I guess we don't have a czar per se. What we do have is we have our team of epidemiologists that are led by one of our senior epidemiologists, and they work with schools. And then I help represent Commissioner Malcolm in those conversations as well. So we do have a more of a team-based approach with our scientists, the epidemiology scientists.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you. One last question. Deputy Commissioner Mueller, I wish you would provide us with the names of the schools or the districts or the charters that had continuous in-person learning and whether or not you collected data from those and to what extent they were following all the protocols and even what the transmission rate might have been within that school district or that area. And then finally, I think it's really important that we know what help did you provide to help teachers know how to deliver from a distance. I observed my grandson, for example, over 3 days of distance learning. And though I thought the teacher was trying hard, I could tell that, you know, there are not the skills for our teachers to know how to deal with, you know, all of those screens that, for example, we can see on this Zoom meeting and the different behaviors. And you know that, you know, even sometimes we're squiggly and we're inattentive and, you know, this is really difficult. So, you know, will you provide it? You don't have to answer now, but would you provide us a summary? And I know I'll be talking to the commissioner soon and we'll ask her as well, but if you could provide us, you know, that document of information so we have that, so we know how to proceed as policymakers as this continues, and we try to help our local school districts and charters with all the questions they have asked along the way, and our teachers and their frustration, our parents, and of course, our children who are most important to us. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, commissioners.
Deputy Commissioner Mueller, any comments on that before you move to the next question?
Madam Chair and Representatives Erickson, we will make sure that we get you that information and provide that to the committee. There are places where we have a lot of that data able to be collected. The one point of clarification I do want to make sure that I provide is I know that this oftentimes right in schools, and I think you know this, Representative Erickson, coming out of a school, is that there's a lot of acronyms. And so there's first and foremost, there's the Regional Centers of Excellence, and the Regional Centers of Excellence are part of what was developed as a support around ESSA, and what we're talking about also is like a second piece is a regional support team coming out of the same group, but actually that regional support team is made up of one person from that service cooperative, as well as then a local public health official, a Minnesota Department of Health official, and then Department of Education, and then they also are working with every single school leader and that school leader's incident command team. So we just wanted to make sure, I think that I just want to make sure that the delineation between those two, and so we will get you that information from the regional support teams.
And Madam Chair, if I may, thank you, Deputy Commissioner Mueller. I think I'm more interested, and we are more interested in the support teams. So be sure we get that information so that we can study that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner Mueller, for being here, and Assistant Commissioner Huffman. So I wanted to, and I'm a mom of three young kids. I have two children that have special needs, and it has been very challenging. I have worked a lot with the disability community, and I just want to thank you because you guys have been so great in addressing concerns that I've raised. So thank you for that. I do want to address just, so first of all, one of our members had mentioned that COVID is like the seasonal flu or made some correlation to that. That's absolutely not true. I just want to make sure that we don't say things that are inaccurate in these meetings. And then I also want to address the consistency of our kids when they go back to school. So Edina is starting school back up in like 2 to 3 weeks. And as we go, some of our school board members and our superintendent have expressed just concern in terms of, you know, how are we going to sustain them being in school without schools closing and opening? Because that's going to be hard for kids. Are those regional teams going to help with that? And I'm just curious, like, in terms of your thoughts around that would be helpful. Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Mueller or Assistant Commissioner Huff, who would like to take that one?
I think, Madam Chair, thank you very much. And Representative Allison, I can start, and then Assistant Commissioner Huff, if you would like to join in and add some components to that. So I really appreciate your comments at the very beginning. Thank you very much. We know that that this is not an easy piece for any of our students and for our families. And so the work that we do, we recognize that is to consistently get better and to try to do the very best we can for every single student every single day. And so as you ask the questions, we know that the transitions can be very difficult on students as well as for our adults. And we are wanting to find as much consistency as possible. The use of really the data that supports it, that's looking in that school level data as well as that community data, is really helping to drive a lot of those pieces, simply because we know that what's happening in that school, if there is any transmission, or if we are seeing some implications of what is happening outside in the community making its way into a school, I mean, those would be the instances where we would need to be thoughtful about our our work with moving a transition and also looking at like any types of quarantines that we need to do, but where those regional support teams are, which are made up of those teams, are each school leader meets with them, they can meet with them and have a consultation as often as they need to be able to have that consultation to continue to track their data, as well as to look at what types of additional mitigation strategies might we want to consider in a particular school setting. Assistant Commissioner Huff, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Edelson, first of all, thank you. Yes, you know, we are in a global pandemic, and this is COVID is much more severe than influenza, although influenza is a severe disease. COVID, unlike influenza, disproportionately impacts older folks and middle-aged folks than it does children. What we at MDH are committed to provide as much guidance and expertise as we can for all of our districts. That's really the goal and the purpose of our safe learning team, so that we have epidemiologists along with experts from the Department of Education to work closely as consultants, as scientific and technical consultants with each school. We cannot prevent exposure from the disease within the community. What we can do is we can mitigate risk. This enhanced safe learning plan does that. We add extra levels of mitigation because our goal is that schools are successful in in-person learning. Our safe learning teams then work with schools if there is an exposure, if there is a case of an infected individual in the school. We immediately work with the school. We conduct contact tracing. We ensure that people that may have been exposed are quarantined so that that disease exposure does not spread to others. Our goal is that schools are successful and that people are safely and healthily able to go back to school.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you for those. And I just want to also just put one other thing out there. I've heard a lot about how teachers, you know, don't necessarily want to go back to school, that they like the distance learning. And I just also want to say that that's not true. Overwhelmingly, teachers want to go back to school. And so thank you to the Department of Health for helping and MDE helping them get there.
Okay, Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you also to our presenters. I really wanted to talk for a minute about middle and high school students. And I know with your updated safe learning plan, you said that you're relying less on the county data, especially for the K through 5 level. Also with the updated mitigation that Assistant Commissioner Huff just talked about too. So I'm wondering if those things are also being looked at as far as our middle and high school students and any updates to the safe learning plan for those.
Deputy Director Mueller or Assistant Commissioner Huff?
Madam Chair, I'll go ahead and start and then we'll see if Assistant Commissioner Huff has anything. Thank you very much, Representative Mueller. I think that there's a couple of different pieces. We're really being thoughtful about this approach. The January 18th, that timeline of really starting to look at having students, especially rolling back into an in-person or a hybrid model who hadn't really been in that model before, was really 2 weeks after most people finished their winter breaks to give us the opportunity to have a quarantine period in that time frame. Also, we know that sports is beginning on practices on January 4th, and games are beginning coming up here on tomorrow, the 14th. And so taking the time to look at, as we bring large populations of people back into our school buildings, really being thoughtful about how we can purposefully watch the data and ensure that as we are bringing our students back in and our staff are back in, that we're making, that the strategies that we are implementing are working. I know that the Assistant Commissioner Huff will probably have more to add to that as well. One of the pieces we've known is that athletics was one of those that was also impacting community spread and looking not only not in that school, but in that community, but also in that school. And so it was really trying to target that. And I think we've also been always been open to
to looking at how is it that we will get our middle school students and our high school students more in person if they have been in a hybrid, or from distance to hybrid to right in person if they've only ever been in a distance learning model. But I think that the strategy is to really be really purposeful about the slow march of walking our large communities of people back in. Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are still using the county level learning model in middle school and high school, but it's important to remember that the county level data is a starting point. It is not the end of the conversation. It provides context. And then the school support teams, that technical and scientific group of advisors, are able to work with the school district and put that into context. I think someone mentioned earlier about concern, say, with a long-term care outbreak or facility that might have cases that might drive up county-level data but would not necessarily impact schools. All that is taken into account. It is a starting point, and it helps to frame the conversation, but there are so many things that we look at, and it is really important to look at what is the most successful, or how do we set up success for schools? Because we understand it is very disruptive if schools are open and close and open and close. So our goal is to get schools open for in-person learning, but do it in a way that is going to maintain continuity and to be safe.
Representative Mueller.
Nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner Mueller and Assistant Commissioner Huff, thank you both for being here today. I appreciate that. I also appreciate the fact that you stated earlier that this plan was founded in data and in science. I can tell you, Assistant Commissioner Huff, you mentioned some of those communities that have disproportionately impacted. Well, I'm a member of communities that are disproportionately impacted by this virus. I know several people that have either contracted the virus. I've also know people that are close to me that have lost more than one family member to this virus already. So it is absolutely serious. So I absolutely appreciate it when we're grounded in facts and we're grounded in science to try to protect our kids as best as possible. With that said, I also have a young one. She's 6 years old, and she will be transitioning into in person next week. We are excited about that. She's excited about that. The teachers are excited about that, and her teacher said more than once in numerous occasions that they can't wait to have the kids back because they know that it's the best way for them to connect and it will produce the best outcome. So I know those to be facts. One of the questions that I do have, and I love the idea that you all use this collaborative approach with the regional support teams. A question that I have is, if there is any disagreement with the regional support team and the school district, how is that resolved? Or is this more of an advisory role for the regional support team, or is it a checks and balance to where the regional support team can actually halt a transition plan that the district may have or want to put in place?
Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier. I'm excited that you have a six-year-old who's excited to come back to school. There's nothing better than that, and I can say that as a teacher. We went into this job because we love to be around students, and so I'm thankful that she's excited. I think that one of the pieces that around your question is really being thoughtful around how is it that we are going to be able is that the regional support teams actually provide mostly feedback. They walk through with the superintendent or the school leader, as well as their incident command team, all a series of questions. They look at data, they walk through their plan. And if they would then say, based on all of this, what are you thinking? If there is a disagreement, they would have that conversation. If they still did not agree on that, then usually it was raised to either the Department of Education or the Department of Health. And then we would have a couple of people come in and look at that plan, like from a more, an outside perspective, and look at that plan and ask a series of questions and then make their recommendation based on that. If there was an egregious shift between a change between what we saw in county level data, their numbers were incredibly high. What was happening in their school was very a large outbreaks as well as in their community. And if there was something that was happening in their hospitals and their hospitals were full, then that recommendation would be
to be counter. Like if they were saying they wanted to be fully in person, we would say probably not for a whole series of reasons. But that was always done in a really collaborative point of a conversation. And so it really gave the regional support teams the opportunity to have that conversation and to provide feedback, and then a place to go where, you know, outside perspectives were able to come to the table and also provide additional feedback.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you for that. One of the things, and I'll just say this and then I'll move on to the next questions, is that you all mentioned earlier that a big reason a lot of the districts went back into distance learning was because of the fact that either staff, faculty members had to quarantine or they contracted the virus. You know, we can't hope this virus away. We can't legislate this virus away. And I really do think that we may see those trends again as we go back to in person. I'm always hopeful because I said my kid is excited to go back. My wife and I are excited for her to have the opportunity to go back. But I just think we really don't have a lot of great answers, and we're trying to do the best we can. So I appreciate the work that you all are doing.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Representative Frazier's questions are kind of a good entry point for my questions as well. I am fortunate enough to represent many educators in my district. It really seems like Northeast Minneapolis is where all the teachers in Minneapolis live too. And we have a lot of young families too. So this is definitely a top of mind question in 60A. But how has MDE and how has MDH worked with school staff on reopening guidance? I know especially MPS is worried about staffing. We've heard of staffing levels across the state having an issue. So how have you worked with staff to prioritize their safety and their comfort with returning to this? And then also, I'm really curious about, and I also really want to thank you for prioritizing all school staff that are face-to-face in the 1B vaccination group. That's really great to see. Thank you for that detail, because it's not just teachers. We know it's our nutrition staff and our ESPs as well. But can you talk a little bit about the timelines around vaccinations and January 18th as a, as where it appears to me that MBE would really like schools to be prioritizing in person for elementary age students. So can you talk a little bit about how you work with our school staff and families in developing this guidelines and that disconnect between maybe our vaccination rates that we're gonna see for the 1B group and where MBE would like schools to start returning to in-person as much as possible.
Assistant Commissioner Huff, would you like to begin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jordan, let me first just address vaccination. Vaccination is changing quickly. As you know, we got some new information from the federal government yesterday, or at least what we received through the mainline media, not necessarily directly from the federal government, might change the prioritization. So we continue to work through that. Our goal is to get as many vaccines in as many arms as possible to maximize for effect. You know, as opposed to just vaccinating everyone, we do want to vaccinate for effect. That's why we're 1A is for folks in long-term care who are the most vulnerable to the disease and severe illness and death. And then for frontline healthcare workers and first responders because of their risk. We definitely want to get educators vaccinated as soon as possible. I cannot give you an update on that right now because we are working through that. We just had our own internal committee, MDH. I don't want to say it's an internal committee. It's an MDH sponsor committee of many external experts to help us determine how we are going to roll out 1B. But there's a lot in flux right now. As you know, our demand for vaccine continues to be much, much higher than our supply, and we are completely dependent upon the federal government for our supply. So we will do everything we can to keep you all in the legislature up to date as we learn more and as we're able to do better planning to prioritize critical workers such as educators.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if Commissioner Mueller would be willing to talk about how staff safety concerns are being taken into consideration and what you've done to work with educators on this plan.
Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, and thank you very much, Representative Jordan. I think there are a couple of pieces. So in addition to what we will articulate about what we've been doing with our school leaders, one of the pieces is we also do have a transition team, which is made up of representatives from Education Minnesota, our school leaders, as well as like Department of Health, local public health, school nurses, regional support team coordinators. So they are part of our conversation there. We also have, we have a great relationship with our school leaders across the state. We have a really great relationship with our Education Minnesota, as well as like our SEU partners. And so I've had conversations with them about the safety and the mitigation strategies that we're putting in place and working with them consistently on those processes. They are also included on those school leader calls on every Thursday so that they are hearing the exact same information and getting that information. In addition, we do also have an advisory group that we started back in, I'd say it was roughly April or May, and it's shifted its focus. Originally, it was really looking at distance learning because that's the model that we were in, and now it's really looking at an equitable, safe learning plan with representatives from across the state to be able to provide us with additional feedback, and that is made up of family members as well as community organizations who help to support students outside of school. Also in constant conversations and contact with our Tribal Nations Education Committee, as well as with our Tribal Nations in the state-to-state and our government consultative processes and ensuring that we are really looking at every single aspect of this work. I know that also Commissioner Ricker, Commissioner Malcolm, and Susan Klammer and I have all had the opportunity to be on calls with Education Minnesota so that they are able to ask questions. I think that happens roughly like once a month. Commissioner Ricker tends to attend those every single month to continue to provide information and feedback and opportunities for people to ask questions. Again, like from the very beginning, the safety, the health, and the wellness of our students, staff, and families was at the very forefront of what we were trying to move forward. Of course, we had never experienced anything like this, and I'll be honest, I hope that I don't ever do it again. I'm not sure anybody wants to again, quite honestly, but I think that this has given us the chance to really hone our relationships and make sure that, right, although sometimes we see things differently, I think our purpose is consistent, and that is our students and our staff and our families.
Any quick final comment, Representative Jordan?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bennett.
Get myself unmuted. Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to correct the record when Representative Scott was talking about COVID versus the flu. She wasn't trying to say that it was the same thing. She was asking for comparison data between children who are sickened or hospitalized or die from COVID versus the same with the regular flu. So I just want to correct that. But my question is for somebody, probably at the Department of Ed, more academic related, but I'm just wondering what kind of data is being collected, particularly in reading and math for our early learners, like maybe K through three. That's such a critical stage, especially for reading. And is the data being tracked to help determine how to get these kids up to speed when they get back into in-person? So just wondering about the data being collected, especially for those early learners.
Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much, Representative Bennett, for that question. So as you know, let's talk specifically about K-3, because that is our third grade's first. As you know, third grade is the first year of like the MCAs or the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment specific to reading and math. And on that particular assessment, we did not give that last year. There was a nationwide waiver on all assessments given by the federal government. And so we do not have MCA data from last year on our third grade levels. However, schools across the state utilize a number of different measures that are give progress monitoring data around reading. And so they give a baseline data where students are coming in and the fall, they get that information for where those students are at. They also then do some type of winter assessment, so they're able to gather the information and the growth from fall to winter, and then usually there's something that happens in the spring, and it usually is in a reading. There are some numeracy components in some, but for sure in literacy. And so not only are they able to have that in that progress monitoring, so those are pieces of information that our schools have. They also have like curriculum-based measures that are based solely in the delivery of the standards and give our teachers a lot of information about what is happening with our students and what their growth is. And so that data is being tracked right now, as always in a K2 setting, based on those curriculum-based measures and on tools that provide assessments that provide not only a baseline growth measure, but also progress the opportunity for progress monitoring.
Madam Chair, quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to clarify, so districts have been able to maintain their formal and informal measurements during this online learning? Is that still taking place pretty much as it always has been?
Well, please proceed.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Representative Bennett. I think that I would not say that it's necessarily the exact same, because oftentimes that is done right in one-to-one in person. And so the opportunity to be able to do that for our students may have to have come over some type of device. I know that there are a number of our staff across the state who are utilizing one-on-one instruction or small group instruction as part of their reading model, to be able to listen to students read and to be able to have that consistent information for their students. And so I would not necessarily say, quite frankly, that it is the exact same as it was in the years prior, but I do know that our schools across the state are gathering as much information as they can about where their students are in their reading or in their and in their assessment of the standards, and are using that in order to continue to guide their instruction.
Thank you.
Representative Bennett, any final comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's see. There, you can see me too now. First of all, just maybe emphasizing a few things here. I do think it's important that we get our students back in school in a traditional setting just as soon as possible, and I appreciate the work being done to try to make that happen. I also believe that we have to look at things like what's going on with the mask mandate. I hear a lot in that area, and we need, I think, to I don't know what the FIED teachers are saying on that, but I think it's important to hear from them. And I guess when I pose my question, that's what I would like the commissioners to answer. Are they hearing from the FIED teachers? How is it working in the FIED classes, having to wear masks? I know that in talking to coaches that they're not very happy. And my little grandson is a hockey player and has to wear the mask. And is finding it very difficult, particularly since he has asthma. And then they have been mentioning the schools and the vaccinations. Well, again, the lower incidence rate of infection for students, well, it's much lower than that of the staff. And it's important to open schools by getting the staff vaccinated if they chose to do so. So I want to urge to do whatever can be done to get our staff vaccinated as soon as possible, so that I think it's an important step toward getting our schools reopened the way they should be. And so my question then is of either of the commissioners, are they hearing from FIED teachers? What is the real justification for wearing these masks in FIED?
Thank you, Representative. Assistant Commissioner Huff or Mueller, would either of you like to take that? And I'll just do a quick note. We only have about 7 minutes left, and we still have a couple of hands up.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to start in, since a lot of it relates to, I think, some of the public health reasons for masking. First of all, I do want to just dispel a popular myth out there relating to asthma. So, you know, masks definitely take adjustment. They're not the most comfortable. I know, you know, frankly, it can be uncomfortable at times. But the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology says that there is no evidence that wearing a face covering makes asthma worse. So masks are not contraindicated for people who suffer from asthma from a medical perspective. We know that masks are the number one most effective public health intervention for people to be able to be outside their home and interacting with other folks and still slow the spread of COVID. Masks do, even just simple cloth masks, do a very good job of keeping in the respiratory particles that contain the virus. And they also provide some protection for the user. So not only am I protecting others, but I'm protecting myself. One of the things that's important to remember in as we look at our safe school plan, it's not only about protecting children from the virus and the impacts there, but it's about protecting the adults who work with children. We're very concerned about protecting the health and safety of those who are working with the children, our educators, our folks who are driving the buses and working in the office or working in food service. Masks are extremely important there. We follow the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines around masking for sports and exertion. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that even during competition and during exertion that children be masked because the ability to stop the spread is really an important thing that we continue to do. Masking is just an excellent public health intervention in that means. And I'll turn it back to Deputy Commissioner Mueller to talk about any of the engagement pieces that we've been doing. Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Mueller.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl. We have heard from some staff members who are not sure that they want their students to be wearing face masks. And we have heard from other staff members that they are thankful that we are asking their students to wear face masks. And so I think that the sentiment that we hear from our staff is similar to the sentiment that we see right in our communities and at large is that there are some people who prefer having their students wear that mask and there are some who do not. And so I think we have heard, quite frankly, a combination of both. We have steady streams of we should not be opening schools because people are very nervous. Families are very nervous, which is why we're continuing a distance learning model. And we hear from families who feel like we need to open up every single school. And so we are continuing to walk that balance and listen to the feedback from our partners in the field, as well as our education organization partners, to ensure that we are providing the very best possible plans that we can that meet the health and safety needs of our students and staff and provide as much of a traditional setting as possible. And so I think that those are, I think, combinations of those pieces.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Erdahl, any last words?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, I think in my summation is, well, let's prioritize getting vaccinations to school staff because, you know, the commissioners were talking about the importance of masking, not just in FIED, but in the classrooms because of transmission to the staff. Well, let's work real hard to make them prioritize to get these vaccinations if they choose to get them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question that's a little bit different than where everybody else has been going. This presentation was extremely informative to me, and I appreciate the work that you're doing. But when we think about health for our students, that's a very holistic approach for me. So it's one thing to talk about our masks and to talk about COVID. My bigger concern is actually the mental health toll, and this is taking on our students. You did mention that our MAO treatment reports have dropped by 40%, mostly to do with the fact that we can't do home visits and we're not there to connect with our students. As somebody who worked pretty extensively as a support staff doing home visits, I know how important that is. And I know that when families are stressed in really high stress, anxiety situations, abuse happens at higher rates. And so my fear is that now that we're home and we don't have those liaisons and support staff connecting with our students, we probably actually have more abuse happening, which in turn would ideally lead, will probably lead to more maltreatment reports. So my question to you is, I know that we're working on this safe learning plan and it's all around COVID, but what areas are you looking at when it comes to a couple things, our mental health support for our kids? We talk so much about ACEs scores and trauma and how that impacts kids.
Representative Keeler, we're at 2:30, so I'm gonna move on and ask Deputy Commissioner Mueller, can you respond to the mental health question? 30 seconds.
Sure. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, Representative Keeler. So what we have primarily talked about is really the academic components and the health components of this of the Safe Learning Plan. What we have not talked about is the work that the Education and Child Care Work Group that has been stood up, as well as what we've been doing with the Department of Education always around mental health, wraparound services to ensure that our students are being fed, to ensure that they have the mental health supports, working with our partners at Department of DHS to ensure that we are partnering around mental health and providing those additional supports, and also looking at what we can be doing as students are coming back in. To your point around students having an ACEs score at this point in time because of the trauma and what has already occurred maybe in their lives prior to COVID. And so looking at ways to be able to help support students not only in their mental health, but their families as well as our staff members who may have experienced some trauma while we have also been away from school. And so there are a number of things that are actually happening outside of just the safe learning plan that we would also be able to talk about.
Assistant Commissioner Hoff, 30 seconds.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for raising that issue. I think this is what is so difficult for us. We are facing a public health emergency in the pandemic, but the effects of that go much beyond just the infectious disease and its impact. The mental health, the emotional health of our children, of all of the Minnesotans, is something that we at Minnesota Department of Health are very concerned about and share your concern. As we see so many of our children suffering in so many holistic ways. So thank you for upholding that and making sure that we focus on the entire child and the entirety of the well-being of the child. So thank you.
And I recognize that we didn't get an opportunity to get to everyone's questions. And Representative Keeler, you asked a really big one at the very end. So do know that the departments remain as resources even afterwards. So if there are additional questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to either Assistant Commissioner Huff or Deputy Commissioner Mueller. And with that, there is no further business before the committee, and we are adjourned.